Talk given Saturday, 14th August, 1976. We have considered time and again the question, what is it that makes us turn to religion and, more important still, living the religious life? I make a slight distinction between the two, because a good many people turn to religion for consolation, for some sort of explanation of the sorrow, the frustration which they experience, or some such cause, the answer to which would satisfy their intellects. They are not specially concerned with living the religious life, which means undergoing, or rather, changing to a way of living which will truly transform themselves, their own nature, their own character, their own daily process of thought and feeling and action, and so forth. So you see, the two are considerably different. The former tends to remain more or less, not altogether, but more or less the same sort of worldling that he was before, which means that himself, his particular little circle, his family, friends, etc., are his primary concern still. He is self-oriented, actually, because although he has this concern for his family and friends, his concern is not born of true selflessness, but is the product of self-identification with family and friends. The other person who lives the religious life in reality is one who undergoes this transformation of his mode of awareness, which is a totally different thing. The self-orientation gives place to an unselfed outlook upon all mankind, upon totality. Now this introduces a very important point in connection with one of the purposes, the deep purposes of our existence. It is only when there is that degree of unselfedness, freedom from self-orientation, that the person can truly flower out into his maturity mentally, into the true harmony of mind and body, and therefore be a living vehicle through whom the energies of transcendence flow in and flow out freely. Such a person is a rare phenomenon. The founders of the great religions, for instance, and many others, have been that sort of person. It has been suggested during our meetings, especially during the last two years at least, that one of the purposes of our existence is precisely that, to become centers, so to empty ourselves that we are centers for the reception of transcendent energies, and they are free outflow from us, around us, onto the world. Now, there have been many like that, and they may number some thousands. But I am considering the time span during which man has been on the globe. A few million years. And during those few million years, surely the number of people who have been born and lived and died must exceed many, many thousands of millions. So a few thousand amongst them doesn't produce even one in a million. Now this is a serious matter. Nature is prodigal. There is a tremendous wastage of material in nature. But perhaps the wastage where the human race is concerned may be greater than the wastage anywhere else, in any of the other kingdoms of nature. The other kingdoms of nature, having no option to disobey the laws under which their own being functions, are in tune with life and life's trends. Very rarely there may be instances where they go out of tune. But man, having this power of option to say yea or nay, to be entirely self-concerned or to grow into maturity. With man it is different. He's a slow learner. And therefore man is going to take a long, long time as a race, as a kingdom of nature on this planet, to approach his maturity. Therefore, the problem is a serious one, because the non-realization of what he is intended to grow into, what the life force is moving him towards, means that he is a producer of so much sorrow for himself and the race, and frustration of the purposes for which mankind exists on the globe. This is where upbringing and education play a very important part. But more important than the part played by upbringing and education is the part which we ourselves as individuals have to play. It is our personal responsibility to awaken to the purpose of our existence. And as I have said, one of these purposes is that we shall so orient the course of our life that our growth and fruition, our maturing in mind and body, will not be hindered, and thereby we can be the instruments, the living vehicles through which transcendence flows in and out freely. Recall the meaning of the word man, the human being, the happy creator. You have all heard this before, so I need not repeat it all. And this happy creativeness is of a nature which thought can never formulate in terms of definite concepts. Because it is something transcendent. You may wonder, why should this be so? The situation in actuality is a little bit like this. You can take a solid object, a three-dimensional object, and put it into a box. You can pack it inside a box. Can you pack a three-dimensional object into a surface? A surface has only two dimensions. That three-dimensional object can be touched by a surface. But so long as it remains the pure surface, two-dimensional only, you can't completely pack the three-dimensional object into the two-dimensional surface. This three-dimensional object in relation to the two-dimensional surface is transcendent to it. It can just touch it, no more. And insofar as it touches it, imagine that surface having human consciousness. A piece of paper, we'll say. Although a paper is a three-dimensional object, but we'll ignore the depth of the thing because it is so thin. Imagine it has something like human consciousness. If the three-dimensional object just touches it, and the paper says, oh, what was that? Something quite extraordinary, something which I just don't know, happened. It may, if it is as clever as some of the clever people in the world are, invent all sorts of theories about it. And in every case, those theories will be false. If you took an infinity of surfaces and pile them on one on top of the other, they never make a three-dimensional object. This is the great mystery, the extraordinary mystery of the emergence of the universe. A point has no dimensions. It is an invisible, intangible, infinite. A non-finite, non-measurable. The boundless universe, as we experience it, is a three-dimensional, for us, a three-dimensional infinite. Now, in terms of mind and consciousness. We human beings get touched by this extraordinary creative power which produces the whole universe. This extraordinary creative power, and we do not know what it is, and we never can know by means of the mind which we have at present. As long as we are constituted as we are, this particular kind of organism with the brain and five senses and so forth, our faculty of speech and our faculty of building up concepts and putting them together and making a meaningful picture by means of which we can communicate with each other, as long as the organism has those limitations, that transcendence in itself remains the unknowable. But just as your three-dimensional object can touch a two-dimensional surface and the surface just says, "Good God, what was that?" So too, this thing which is transcendence, when it touches us, psychophysical organisms, with mind and consciousness limited as it is, we can be touched in the depths of mind and consciousness, and we can say, "Ah, the mystery, the wonder." We say God, we say the absolute, the infinite, and so forth. Something which calls forth out of our being awe and reverence and the sense of extraordinary peace and beauty and wonder and the passion completely to give ourselves to it, provided the brain remains quiet and empty and refuses, does not stoop to building up concepts about that which no concepts can ever represent, represent. I suggest this is a matter for deep meditation. Meditation in the meaning of the complete emptying, the complete silencing of the mind and the brain. You can't silence the mind and the brain deliberately by any sort of technique, any sort of forceful means. You can observe all that obstructs the silence. And if you just remain quiet, not impelled by any sort of will or desire, the quietening will naturally take place. When it has taken place, you won't know it. In the time of the quietening and the stillness, you don't know it. It is like when you are in profound slumber. You don't know that you are asleep. But that is the time when this transcendence suddenly manifests itself. It touches you. Now, there is a difference between the state of profound slumber which the body experiences, that silence, between that silence and this silence when the body is awake. as I suggested, with the three-dimensional object touching the piece of paper. If the brain happens to be perfectly quiet and still, just watching, just alert, sensitively alert, not looking for anything, not pouncing upon whatsoever comes to it and immediately giving names to it or producing a thought process, because that completely destroys the whole thing immediately. If the brain happens to be like that, in that condition, then the innermost depths of mind which lie dormant in us will be aware of this extraordinary... Now I have to descend into words, all of which are misleading, of the extraordinary immeasurableness. The power, the beauty. The power, remember, which is not measurable, like electrical energy or heat energy or anything else. It's immeasurable. It doesn't belong to the realm of limitation. And that beauty is utterly free of all our criteria of beauty that we learn through our socio-cultural heritage and our process of learning in the world. Symmetry, color, shape, beauty, proportions and everything. All this cultural development, including the productions of genius, although the productions, the supreme works of the greatest geniuses do give you a sense of transcendence, but they are all within the sphere of this measurable mortal beauty. A beauty that ultimately fades away. A beauty that is associated with the disturbance of the inner depths of mind, as well as the surface mind. But that beauty is not associated with disturbance, although associated with an extraordinary sense of action, of rhythmic vibrancy. This is the extraordinary thing about it all. You see now why those few through the millennia who have realized things like this have always come up against the impossibility of telling another person. That is why this thing, transcendence, this thing, the unio mystica, the realization of the ultimate reality possible for man to realize, is talked of as ineffable. It cannot be passed on. Because whatever can be passed on is something which undergoes a motion of translation. And a motion of translation implies space and time. And the movement of any finite particular thing into another space and time. But here there is no finitude. How can I ever talk of this transcendence touching the living person? But if the words that are said can produce some sort of vibrating somewhere in your inner being, don't look for it, don't search for it. You can't see it, you can't know it. But if it can occur, somehow it will find its way through in your lives. And it will make a complete difference, an unspeakable difference in your whole life. You will cease to care in the way that we care in our ordinary everyday life. However wonderfully, however marvelously we may rise to the sublimest heights and the profoundest depths of caring for people, for animals, for trees, for life, for all the worthy things as we call it, that caring, you will find, undergoes a complete breakdown, a complete dissolution. And a new caring comes into being. A new caring which is marked by one characteristic specially. It is not you who care. It is the care of transcendence itself functioning through you. If you can get the feel of this, you will have an actual experiencing, a realization of what theists have meant when they said, God loves you and cares for you. That loving and caring has no relationship to anything that you and I know of loving and caring. That is why when that loving and caring brings pain and sorrow into our lives, we say, my God, why hast thou done this unto me? We don't understand it. Why? We are packing the three-dimensional object into a surface. We are being not altogether sensible. But you will find that in course of time, because this thing enters into your life more and more, into your being, your inner being, not into your life in terms of the daily cookery and the washing and all that sort of thing, or even having meetings like this and giving talks in fashion sublime, not that way. But it will come more and more into your life. In fact, you will become more and more the living vehicle through which that extraordinary creativeness and creative activity of transcendence will function through the living man, the living woman, you yourself. But you see how all this relates to our practical task, so to say, where living the religious life is concerned. This being suffused by transcendence can only take place through the unresisting living vehicle. How do I, the mortal, self-centered man, become the unresisting vehicle for the transcendent? This is where the fundamental basic teachings of religion all come in. The purification of the psychophysical organism, involving the daily mode of life which is pure, which is simple, which is ethical in supreme measure, which is non-grasping, non-demanding, non-self-expanding, free of all ambitions, desires, pursuits, all our worldly enthusiasms, particularly those in the name of God and doing good to mankind, and rushing about with mighty energy, supporting great causes and so forth, which all seem excellent, but we are never able to penetrate into all the other things associated with what seems so desirable. We have to be free of all that. Just a few words on this last point. Take medical science. It takes for granted that to prolong life is desirable and good and right, and imposes it as a medical duty. It appeals to human beings, not because human beings know the meaning or significance of life or the art of living humanly, but because they are greedy to continue the self. I want to continue, cabbage that I am, idiot that I am, and all the rest of it. And what has been the consequence of prolonging life? Just this senseless prolongation, this clinging to life. Sometimes you get the opposite reaction. A man's life is prolonged, but the conditions under which they are prolonged and the frustrations he undergoes in being unable to fulfill his passions and his desires, or the trouble he creates and sets up in life, makes him commit suicide, which is an act of vengeance upon society, an act of hate against himself and society. So you see, we have to beware of these enthusiasms. But listen, when one is empty of all that is like dirt, then the true beauty of yourself shines out. Your fulfillment is actually present there. And the loveliness of it is that you don't know it. the most beautiful woman, the most handsome man in the world. If he never saw a reflection of himself or herself in a mirror or in a pool of water or whatever it may be, would never see just what his face is like. Isn't that so? But it is in this divine unknowing of that which belongs to the finite, limited self, awakens you to the transcendent awareness of being that which transcendence wanted you to be. We can appreciate then something of the meaning of being unselfed, being utterly free of the image of the self. And when one is utterly free of these things, one's absorptiveness, one's inner strength, which is in truth an infinite resiliency, operates freely. And when it operates freely, it doesn't oppose anything, it doesn't fight against anything at all, because the infinitely resilient can not only be not slain, it cannot even be hurt. This is in mind and consciousness. The body will be hurt. The body can be slain, because the body by its very constitution offers the resistance of a solid, liquid object against other solid or whatever objects they are. Right? But this is in mind and consciousness. And because it is in mind and consciousness specifically, it is specifically within the sphere which comes under the term man. Then you are truly man, truly woman. And in that is supreme fulfillment. So you see, the so-called techniques for purification, as the Buddha put it so beautifully, the parable of the raft. The raft is for crossing to the other shore. But you see the difficulty with all such imagery. The Buddha knew what he meant when he talked of the other shore and this shore. But I, the common mortal, interpret the other shore and this shore in my way, which is the mistaken way of the imperfect human, of the bungling human. The other shore and this shore are one and the same. The stream which you cross over is also the same thing. It is all here now. Think of that other statement of the Buddha. I say to you that within this fathom-long body, well, you know the rest of it, is the whole story, the origin and the source of all that is ill, and the way of escape, as it is called. I think escape, it would be better to translate, is the way of release, is also in this fathom-long body. Now you see, one of the profound significances when the yogic system as such lays emphasis upon a discipline of the body, which enables the body to be as unresisting as possible to this, to these profounder realities. Now, the discipline of the body, purely as a body, will only go a little way, a very small way, and not the whole way, unless it is completely associated with the other aspects of the discipline. We talk in terms of this aspect, that aspect, and that aspect, different aspects. It is all actually one aspect. I've written a little bit about this in my book. When you say body, you have also said mind and spirit. When you say mind, you have also said body and spirit and everything else. Because the living human being is an integration, is a whole integrated thing, living thing, you see. It is our brain, and it is the functioning of our senses and our analytical tendency, which, in order to enable us to talk about these things, splits up the whole into different parts. But when the immeasurable pervades you, suffuses your being with itself, you will be in the condition of complete integration. And nothing will be split up. That is the state of light, of vision, of pure understanding, the meaning of the knowledge of God, the meaning of the Buddha's words when he says, and when he had the monk, the bhikkhu, has seen with perfect insight all the truth about himself, all the overflows of consciousness into sense lusts, the passion for becoming this, that, or the other, into intellectual speculations, and into a state of downright ignorance. They have all ceased, and he knows that this is the end of all conditioned states, the jatis, conditioned states of mind and consciousness. Don't translate it as births and rebirths. That gives you a false picture altogether. The end jati, the conditioned state, done what had to be done, katam karaniyam, done what had to be done. And he knows that there is now no more of being such and such and such and such, this thing, that thing, like a frog jumping from here to there and there to there and so forth. There is no more of being such and such, because you are in the state of integration, of liberation, of an immutability of transcendence manifesting through all the mutability of day-to-day existence. The great paradox comes to life, to fulfillment. Realized divinity, if you like. This is the meaning of Buddha. This is the meaning of the absolute, of the essence of mind, of pure mind. These different phrases are used by different cultures and different people all over the world, but they talk of the one identical thing, this ultimate reality. This is what the Upanishads meant when they used those two words, Atma and Brahman. This is what Eckhart meant when he said Gottheit and Gott. So you see, just one more word. These things which have been presented as the basis of morality, the discipline of the body and breathing, and the meditative processes. Be very careful. We get misled by all that because we do not have those liberated ones today to teach us. We get misled into thinking, I'll do this, then I'll do that, then I'll do that, and I know. It's all wrong. What will happen to me is that the me will become totally absent. And therefore, very much the living light. Altogether the living light. Remember those last words of the Heart Sutra, gate gate paragate parasangate. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. But where is that beyond? Here. See? And that living light is always invisible. You can't see light. You see objects because they reflect light, because they resist the light and send it back to you. So you get an impression of seeing the object. But do you see the light by which the object is made visible? When you look at the sun, you say, cannot look at that terrific light. It's not the light you're looking at. It's the effect of the intensity of that phenomenon of heat and light simultaneously, which hurts the eyes and so forth. So, this living of the religious life, this transformation of the individual into the living vehicle for transcendence, this is what we have to give ourselves unto. Totally and completely.